Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. NBA Finals upon us. We will, of course, have full coverage of that tomorrow night. But first, we need to talk about Lonzo Ball, who's the most interesting player to me in this draft. Very, very unconventional. Did a very deep dive. I probably watched more film of him than I have on any of these other prospects. So we're going to get right into that momentarily. First, though, a reminder, we are sponsored today by Smile Direct Club. Visit smiledirectclub.com and use the promo code CAPSPACE for 50% off your evaluation on custom invisible aligners. And also, Audible. You can start a 30-day trial and your first Audible book is free. Audible.com/CAPSPACE is the way to get started with them. So, Ball, many people have said this, Schmitz has said this, is one of the more difficult prospects to evaluate because he is so unconventional. He combines a lot of interesting strengths. I would say the number one thing that stuck out to me about him, though, is that his basketball IQ for a 19-year-old is just off the charts, like absolutely ridiculous on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, the analogy I used talking with somebody over the weekend about him was, so there are people who grew up like for a long time playing poker and, you know, they would play sometimes in rooms and all that kind of stuff. But then the guys who played online got so much more experience because the hands were so much faster. And so it felt like they'd seen everything before, even when they turned like 21 or whatever the age is in that jurisdiction. That's what Lonzo Ball is to me. He's somebody who, for whatever reason, seems like he's seen this all before.
Offensively, he just has, I think I was even more, his vision is very impressive. I was even more impressed with just his ability to manipulate space on the floor when he's cutting, when it's things like just a small thing, like he was getting denied out on the perimeter. So he just kind of ran towards the guy with the ball and just was able to cut off the angle for the denial and get the ball. I don't think I've ever seen anyone his size, certainly no point guard, get as many alley-oops as he did. And part of that is because he actually can get up there and go get it. But just his knack for cutting off the ball anytime there's penetration, he's not just a three-point shooter who's looking to spot up every time. His ability to go back to, I mean, he probably had, like, was averaging, like, you know, one alley-oop dunk a game almost. And so much of it is just from making smart cuts. Defensively, his activity level when he's locked in, I mean, which is always a little bit of a question for a prospect this young, but generally he's just always in the passing lanes. Every pass that's thrown by him, he may not get it, but he'll at least get his hand to the exact level of where the ball is. And maybe his arms aren't long enough to deflect it, but he's just going after every pass. He's making guys uncomfortable. He's coming off his own man as a help defender to block shots. And he's got outstanding acceleration in a straight line, and so that really can help a lot when he is trying to work as a help defender. He gets a fair number of blocks even as well, and his blocks happen more organically, I think, than Markel Fultz's, even though Markel Fultz, for example, has a higher block rate. Ball kind of just gets his in the flow of the offense as a help defender instead of just like spectacular chase down and transition type of plays. Just always seem to know where to be, preternatural anticipation as a help defender to get in front of the next pass. Even when, you know, UCLA played a lot of 3-2 zone and he was at the top of that 3-2 zone, but you would see him drop down into the paint all the way down to the baseline and make steals sometimes, or get out to the wing and make steals when the situation called for it. And I think his on-ball defense, as far as like getting over screens, not that bad to me. Like, he was pretty good at slithering over it, competing. He's got the length. You know, there are a couple of plays, I think, three times in that game against Markel Fultz up in Washington, he actually like got over the screen and surprised Fultz. And one time he blocked his jumper, and twice more he made him throw a desperation pass to avoid getting it blocked. You know, that's the type of plays he's able to make, surprising people, showing up in areas that you just don't expect him to be in.
It's also so fun with him because it can manifest itself, as you said, like with alley-oops in surprising ways. And it all does line up though with basketball IQ. And I'm very excited to see what he can do with better surrounding talent. I mean, UCLA was favorable offensively in a lot of different ways. They had shooting on the floor. They had capable ball handlers.
This is interesting to me, actually, because I think if he goes to the Lakers, he's actually going to be operating with like less surrounding talent and less space on the floor than he had at UCLA. That was actually going to be one of my points.
As a relative proposition. Yeah, you're right.
He was put in one of the best possible environments to succeed, although certainly he deserves a ton of credit for helping to turn around what had been a bad UCLA team as well.
They certainly had been. And I think that it's a fair point to say offensively. Defensively, I mean, they were an absolute disaster, but it's not like there's necessarily going to be a ton of defensive talent on this Lakers team if that's where he ends up either, at least in the early days. Later on, hopefully, they'll be better.
So the two things that give me some pause about him, and we'll break down his offense, obviously, starting with his defense, maybe isn't the place, but that's just the thing that stuck out to me the most, is just his overall instincts and feel from the game. Just his understanding of team ball and where guys are on the floor and how to get himself open are all really just like next level type of stuff. Two things give me pause about him. One is just, you know, the unconventionality of his shot. And yeah, he's got range on it. He shot 41%. He took a lot of attempts too to get to that 41%. But he's also a 67% free throw shooter. Doesn't get to the foul line very much either, by the way. And only 3.1 free throw attempts per 40 minutes. So maybe part of that is just simply the fact that he's not getting there that much and just wasn't in rhythm as much at the foul line, and that he's a good enough natural shooter that that'll alleviate itself. So that's one aspect. Just, you know, he shoots this shot from the left side of his body. It's tough for him to shoot going right. We almost never saw him do that. He showed he can make it a couple of times, but it's not as comfortable. You know, I mean, best case scenario, he gets to be like Kevin Durant, where KD can go to his right, but he definitely much prefers going to his left, because and his the way he brings the ball up on the left side of his body is much more extreme than even KD. That's number one. Number two is, man, 18% usage rate just seems so incredibly low for someone that you're expecting to be really a star. And is he dynamic enough from individual scoring perspective with the ball in his hands to be just like an absolute dominant type of player at the NBA level? That's when you're drafting someone number two, because you think they can dominate. And I'm not sure that he is quite a good enough scorer that he can really is going to be able to at the NBA level bend the defense to him so that he can open up those passing angles. Now, he's still probably gonna make a lot of plays even if he doesn't turn into like a really solid scorer. But it just, I mean, I can't remember another player who was drafted, unless they just were like, you know, a center who was like profiled as an unbelievable defender, who had that low of usage that was expected to be, you know, a superstar the way people kind of expect Lonzo to be.
And one of the reasons why we use barometers like that is because there is a historical precedent. And so you look at that and you say, okay, well, guys who have this kind of a profile generally don't work out, or they don't even have the opportunity to exist, is in kind of a better way to put it. But a question I had for you, because one of the fun things about Lonzo is we didn't watch him together. We haven't talked about him really at all. I wanted to see what you thought about his, I like to use the word wiggle, but his ability to change directions and kind of dribble moves, because that's something that always stood out to me with Markelle Fultz. And when I went back and was watching more Lonzo, you know, kind of in bursts now, as opposed to during the season, it seemed to me like he was more of a straight line dribbler than I had noticed originally.
Yes, I kind of touched on that a little bit already. Yeah, he doesn't have a ton of wiggle, doesn't really create separation with crossovers. Now, his straight line acceleration, as I said, is excellent. And he's got the ability to step way back, going to his left to create space for that shot. But in isolations, he was very efficient. In ISOs overall on the season, 40 points on 33 ISO possessions, 1.2 points per possession. Now, it's only one per game. That's pretty low for a college point guard. Generally, and in the pick and roll, from a dead standstill, you know, I think it might be tough for him a little bit. Like, hasn't shown a ton of ability of like changing speed, snaking, getting the guy on his back. Now, he could certainly get to that point. I mean, I don't think, but his handle is pretty basic. I think he's can be prone to getting pressured up. Like, I think in the second Kentucky game, they actually set a screen for him in the backcourt a lot of times when De'Aaron Fox was pressuring him up. And Fox, of course, is a wonderful pressure defender in the full court. But I think there is definitely a possibility that guys can get into him, that he's not going to be able to blow by some of the best defense, that he might not be able to beat some of the best defenders on switches as well, the best big defenders, that it's kind of, all right, you know, you've got to step back to your left. By the way, he had 11 points on 4 possessions on step backs going to his left out of isolations. Pretty impressive. If he's going to go right, it's to drive usually. But yeah, I mean, you don't see him crossing guys over, losing guys off the dribble. And that is a concern. We're talking about drafting someone this high, but as we said, he's not a conventional type of player. And I think ultimately you're going to look at him as, he'll continue to be a controversial player because I think a lot of things other than assists and just shooting a certain percentage on threes, you know, he's not going to score as much as a lot of guys, right? You're going to have to look at, all right, how good is the offense when he's on the floor because he makes all these great passes and just hits ahead, to reverses the ball, secondary assists, spacing the floor with his shooting if it becomes what people hope that he could, that it could be, you know, how effective he is as the help defender. Like all of those things, I think, are going to be the test for him so much as just, all right, yeah, this guy's scoring 14 points a game here. Like, how good can he really be?
They're very different players, but I think about all of the hot and sometimes stupid takes I've seen on Ricky Rubio, and I could feel like a lot of that kind of stuff offensively could be in the Lonzo repertoire, where it's, you know, it's like, hey, how can a guy who's only scoring 8 or 9 points a game, how can he be that important? And then you look at it, then you're making all these arguments, well, look, they're scoring all this with their, and that also ties in with the part that is spectacular about him is Lonzo Ball in transition is awfully impressive, more as a passer than as a scorer, but he has a good sense of where to go on the court then as well.
Yeah, let's hit that in a second. I did a couple more notes on the ISO thing.
Sure.
He did basically win both Oregon games by ISOing at the end of those, getting the switch and then either pulling back for the jumper or getting to the rim and finishing. So that was impressive. And I also noticed that on the few mid-rangers that he took almost no mid-range shots, no floaters on the year, probably, you know, maybe like 15 all year, if that. He did kind of change his form up a little bit. He got more of a jumper. The few floaters he took looked okay. So I do think he can be a little more effective in the mid-range than he's shown. And when he was asked to isolate, I mean, it's when you look at him, you're like, okay, he probably wouldn't be that good of an ISO player, but he was effective doing that during the season. And you have to at least give him some credit for that. Yeah, transition is where it's at. The hit-ahead passes, he's a pretty solid defensive rebounder. The grab and goes, pushing the ball up floor. And then also his ability to shoot, relocate in semi-transition and get open, go backdoor in semi-transition is really fantastic. Fantastic, but just the hope is that if you draft this guy, he can get your team into a running mentality, get you easy buckets, especially for a team that doesn't maybe have the type of one-on-one scores in the half court, that you can get some easy points with him pushing the ball up floor.
It's a big part of how he changed the culture at UCLA, because while running is always fun, it's a lot more fun when you know that there's a good chance that you get rewarded if you do the right thing. And Lonzo is great about that, at rewarding the guys who hustle, creating open looks, and maximizing those opportunities. And so UCLA, the team completely bought in, and he revamped their offense, a lot of that coming through transition. And I have very little doubt that that part of his game will translate.
I will talk more about Lonzo in a second. Got tons more to discuss with him. But first, I want to let you know that today's show is brought to you by Audible. I have actually been an Audible subscriber since 2005, especially once I started working as a lawyer, working this job. If I'm at home, I'm in front of the computer, I'm usually got something going on, I'm on Twitter, hard to relax and read a book sometimes. But Audible gives you a chance to do that, especially as we're getting into the dreaded summer months after July, when there won't be as much NBA audio content out there. Audible can help you out there. I love listening to sci-fi. I just finished the Commonwealth series by Peter F. Hamilton. Those are 2,000-page long books. And I actually used WhisperSync technology, which is where you can buy a book for your Amazon Kindle, then you add WhisperSync via Audible. And now wherever you leave off reading on your Kindle or on your mobile device, then you get in the car, fire up Audible, and you're right at the same spot that you left off. It's seamless. It's fantastic. You read until late at night and, oh man, like, I just don't want to go to bed, but I have to because I have to get up for work the next day. Well, now you can continue the book from right where you left off seamlessly on your way to work by listening to Audible in the car. So the way to get started with Audible, start a free 30-day trial in which your first Audible book is free. Learn more at audible.com/capspace. Easy to remember that URL, of course, because we talk about capspace all the time on the program. That's audible.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us and get some great audio entertainment at audible.com/capspace. So you talked about transition. That dovetails into his finishing, which, again, not very high volume, getting to the rim on his own. So much of his finishing is off those great cuts and alley-oops along the baseline that we talked about. But this can kind of show you, I mean, I think he's got pretty solid tools. You know, he can get to the rim quickly. He's got some bounce. He's not going to dunk on people, but, you know, he can get up for a tip dunk in transition, or, you know, if he's open in the half court. took 69 shots at the rim this year. I watched all of them. Only two of them were blocked, which is absolutely insane for a point guard prospect.
Some of that is helped by his size, but a lot of it is more just him knowing when to attack and when not to attack, and also having such a great sense of floor spacing and when pressure was going to come.
He's also a solid offensive rebounder. Not a ridiculous rate, 3.2%, but he can get in there for some tips off of his own misses sometimes, or just because he's made a cut around the baseline and just happens to be in there when the shot is taken. He's good at bouncing up and getting like a quick one-hand tap in. Every once in a while, he'll take off a little bit too far away without much of a plan and not quite able to extend to the rim and finish. But still, I mean, he's not taking a ton of really contested finishes over bigs. Part of that was their system where they always had 4 3-point shooters on the floor. It was much more of a pro offense. They ran a lot of stuff where, you know, they would run a horn set and he'd run a pick and roll and they'd lift the opposite big, which is usually TJ Leaf, and Leaf is a good 3-point shooter. Pick and roll also, there's been some talk that maybe he's not as good in pick and roll. The only way I would agree with that is just kind of the lack of shiftiness, the lack of ability to change a ton of speeds. And I think he can still get there with his intelligence level. You'd have to imagine that he can add that to his game eventually. It's more just that they ran a lot of sets to get him on the move, especially going to his right with some speed coming off a pick and roll. Like they had one set where they'd start off with one of their other ball handling guards on the right side of the floor. That guy would then cross over to the left side of the floor and then do like a little dribble pitch to Lonzo. And then Lonzo could take off going to his right and get the screen, you know, around the top of the key, which was good because, you know, that didn't give the guard a chance to kind of get into him and ice him and force him away from the screen. You know, so how good is Lonzo going to be when against drop coverages if he doesn't have a big man who can shoot? If he's got to just attack a big man who's laying in wait for him, can he pull up in the mid-range? Now, his ability to fit passes into really tight spaces will help a lot with that, right? Like he throws these beautiful lob passes into the post, beautiful lob passes to the roll man. If the pop man is open, he'll find him. If someone on the wing just takes one step into the paint, he'll dime someone up. Even and he's so unselfish, it's not even like, oh, I'm gonna throw it to you when you're wide open. It's all right, your guy is leaning just a step to the side, I'll throw it to you, and now you're gonna be able to make a play and you can do the drive and kick afterwards because your guy is just has to close out on you just that little bit. You know, like those are the types of passes he makes. Like LeBron, Harden will make those kind of passes where you see a guy lean the wrong way and they can throw it to him, but Lonzo will give it up even earlier maybe than those guys will. And I think his vision is really impressive. The question is going to come when, all right, if you're playing him 2-on-2 in the pick and roll, now is he going to be able to score or not enough to be dynamic enough that you got to bring that third guy over and he can really make it work with his passing, but you got to draw an extra guy to the ball first before you can do that. What do you think on that score?
I think he'll be able to take advantage of inadequate coverage. You know, he'll tie in kind of like what we've seen with DeMar DeRozan and other guys, where he can do fine in the regular season because teams aren't necessarily gearing up for Lonzo Ball and all that type of stuff. But then if he's on a team that makes it far enough in the playoffs, then teams are going to find his weaknesses. They're going to capitalize on them and work with that. And it all ties in, though, with something that I think is one of the most interesting Lonzo Ball questions, which is if he doesn't create as reliably as the, you know, as the lead ball handler, as the point guard, whatever you want to use, I think he can provide real value off ball, being more of like a kind of more in the line of what Bradley Beal does, but maybe more of what Washington wished Bradley Beal did offensively early on when they wanted him to run the second unit and all that sort of stuff. I think that if that's the fallback, I think it works.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say Beal is the comparison just because Beal has that classic jumper and he's comfortable pulling up in mid-range in a way that Lonzo maybe isn't. But I do like the fact that he can play off the ball, that he likes to get open off the ball, that he shoots threes almost exclusively. He wants threes. And also just his ability to space deep. You know, if he can continue shooting really deep three-pointers, we saw what a weapon that can be, for example, with Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson this year. You know, I think Lonzo, it appears, will be able to have that type of range. So and that also can help on some of these pick and rolls too, especially if he's going to his left. If you go under on him, he can will theoretically be able to pull up. Now, if you're going against an over and drop system, that's when I wonder if he can make the play. If he's got a guy on his hip, can he rise up? Can he get to the foul line? Is he going to learn the little tricks to get to the foul line? Can he go into the big and finish if someone's waiting for there for him? Can he do a midget dribble and then maybe find the big eventually? If they just switch it, is he going to be able to make a play? Like, and that's what's going to make the difference to me between, I think he's going to be a very solid player, unless just for some reason, like his shooting just doesn't translate. Other than that, I think he's going to be a very solid player. He'll be a good point guard. He'll pass the ball, but you know, is he going to be Ricky Rubio who can shoot, or is he going to be, you know, a really dynamic player who can finish at the rim? And I think, you know, he shot 72% at the rim this year. So that's a far cry from Rubio, but he also really picked his spots, didn't have a ton of volume. So that's going to be the big question for me. Let's see what else I had here.
Well, so I had something for you.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
On a lot of people are drawing from not only the Kentucky game. I'm sure the NCAA tournament game, De'Aaron Fox did a wonderful job on Lonzo Ball and deserves credit for that. And I thought that did raise some red flags. But I also thought that Arizona in the Pac-12 tournament did a nice job of pressuring him too. And that was another concerning thing for me in terms of whether he'll be able to create separation at the next level.
Yeah, and full court pressure in the NBA isn't as much of an issue. I mean, yeah, sure, if they bring in the backup point guard and he likes to do that, that's fine. But very few starting point guards are going to do stuff like that. Patrick Beverley maybe a little bit. I will say also that just how well targeted his passes are really incredible. I mean, there are a lot of times when it didn't look like the roll guy was open and he found a way to get it to him anyway. You know, and there were flashes. Like there was one time I saw he was able to snake a pick and roll and pull up for a J on the right side from 15, or he was able to get to his floater game. So I think they're just small little bits of the type of game he's going to need to develop more. And just with his IQ being so high, I think he's going to get there to being, you know, a very, very solid pick and roll player eventually. And then you mentioned him as well as a spot up guy. He also just, you know, is a great drive and kick guy as well. Like if he can get in the lane, he does have a good intelligence for, all right, I'm going to make you guard me. Even though I'm planning to pass here, I'm going to make you guard me enough that it's going to open up some kind of a pass.
And to me, that's a definitely translatable skill. Like the idea that he can make all that work, and it can apply whether he plays, you know, on the ball a lot or whether he's off. And that's part of the reason why I was so intrigued by his fit with Ben Simmons had that come to pass, but it looks like it won't now.
Another thing I think he could really benefit from is if he eventually gets a little bit of a post game at 6'6", 6'9", wingspan, because he generally is going to be guarded by probably smaller defenders, and that's part of where his passing ability is great. But it doesn't even have to be like, you know, some fadeaway jump shot type of thing, but just the ability to back down, shoot a floater over his left shoulder, because I think he's always going to be not the greatest scorer. Like he just needs to have enough things to keep the defense honest, and he's always going to be like scrounging some points here, scrounging some points there, getting open in transition, going back door on occasion. I mean, I think if Luke Walton tries to make this Lakers offense, if he does go to the Lakers, more of a Warriors style, like he'll just be a devastating cutter in that offense. And the egalitarian style, I think, will be very good. And I think defensively, it would be nice if he could get stronger. I mean, he looks like really more of a 1-2 defender right now. He only weighs 190 right now, which is pretty thin for his size. Doesn't really have the type of frame that I think is going to add a lot of weight the way you might say Markelle Fultz or Dennis Smith would, to where you see him getting a lot stronger. So maybe he won't be able to switch on to threes very well. And I think he certainly could be beaten by quicker point guards. But, you know, if you're comparing him to D'Angelo Russell, his potential future teammate, he certainly has a lot more potential than him. And just like he's always doing something on defense to make guys uncomfortable, whether it's just stunting down on post players or just going to double team at the exact right time. It really is remarkable how good his instincts are on both ends. Like, that's what I keep getting back to. And, you know, I definitely really want him to succeed because I like the way that he thinks the game is just so impressive to me.
It would be amazing if we could see him influence a generation of high school and middle school kids to, because so many, as you just said, so many of the things that he relishes and that he's really good at just make basketball better to watch. And if guys worked hard on being cutters, looked for the extra pass, did look ahead passes, even if they don't have his vision, that mentality is contagious. It happened at UCLA. It very well could happen in his NBA team. And it makes youth basketball, I mean, I've watched more youth basketball in the last couple of years than before. The more Lonzo Balls we have, the better.
What concerns you about him? If there's, is there anything we haven't mentioned yet?
Well, we talked about it a little bit, but I think it warrants repeating. Getting to the line and making free throws. It's such a small sample size that the making free throws might not be a concern, but 2.7 attempts per game is not nearly enough. And that is, you know, in a system that we said was very favorable to him in a lot of ways. They had so much floor spacing. And sure, there were times that he probably got a better pass and a better shot for a teammate than something he could have done at the foul line. But you worry about that. And then the jump in terms of athleticism from college to the pros. Yes, he did well at moments against Markel Fultz and numerous other guys who will be in the NBA. But game in, game out, there's just such a big jump from the average Pac-12 point guard to, let's say, Jeff Teague. You know, like Jeff Teague is a phenomenal basketball player and better than anybody that he's gone against so far. And so I'm not confident that he will necessarily be able to defend ones full time. I think he's smart enough that they'll be able to figure it out, but it's one of those things that I'm just going to have to see it. I think I'll know in summer league. I think I'll have a good sense that early, but I'm still going to want to see it.
And some of the statistics really are quite mind-boggling. 100th percentile for pick and rolls as the ball handler, plus the assists arising out of pick and rolls. That's 72% at the rim. True shooting percentage, 67%. Absolutely ridiculous for a college guard. Great steal and block numbers as well. I mean, it's just that free throw rate and the usage rate. And he was incredibly efficient at the rim. I mean, to have that type of true shooting when you're not getting to the foul line hardly at all. I mean, he's taking 57% of his shots from downtown as well. And so again, there's a little bit of a concern there of whether he can create enough 2-point shots to really keep the defense honest as a scorer. But that efficiency, I mean, his spot up efficiency, another thing that was totally ridiculous. 95th percentile on spot ups. He had 115 points on his 85 no dribble jumpers. And then when he steps back, he had 15 points on his 9 jumpers off the dribble. That's always basically stepping back to his left so he can shoot that shot off his left hip, but he's behind the 3-point line and he's covering a lot of ground. And he gets, I mean, I think if he could add the element of coming off screens to shoot 3-pointers, and I think that's something that he might be able to add eventually. And he's able to catch on the hop. He has a pretty quick release. He'll have some really bad misses, though. That's a reason I worry a little bit. You know, his form is so unconventional. When a guy has a lot of bad misses, you worry about how repeatable their shooting is. But I will say that, I mean, I find it very unlikely that if he spots up from like 26 feet away, the teams are going to not guard him. You know, we'll put it that way. I mean, it would take, with the reputation he has coming in, it'll take a while of missing those shots for teams to not respect him out there. And that just simply having to be guarded out there makes such a difference.
We talked on during our finals preview about the idea of the Cavs defending Draymond really more as a passer than a driver, a shooter himself, when he gets that kind of head of steam going towards the paint. Do you feel like that's the best way to defend Lonzo too?
Yeah, I think to just make him beat you for mid-range, leave a guy back there and say, all right, we're going to make you finish over this guy at the rim. But then if he can be a good enough 3-point shooter, then maybe you can't play that coverage, because if his guy gets screened off, especially if he's going to his left, he can just pull that three. And if he's able to make that shot, or if he can, I don't know whether he's going to try to rejigger his form a little bit to where he can shoot a little better going to his right. Like, he did make one, but it looks so awkward. You know, Schmitz has that on his video if you're curious to look at it. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely really weird to go to your right and then bring the ball up from your left hip as you're going to your right. It's pretty odd.
It's like those quarterbacks who are scrambling the wrong direction and then try to throw the ball off the opposite foot. It's kind of what it
looks
right.
Like. Yeah. It's like the right-handed quarterback rolling left who, like, tries to throw it back across his body and gets it picked off every single time.
All right,
so where I reserve the right to change my mind a little bit, although pretty much I think every analytical model that I've seen has had Ball in the top three, and I think most of them seem to have him above Fultz, actually. I know KP's did as of the middle of the year. I haven't seen his final projection. Andrew Johnson came out with his today. I think Ball was number one in his as well. And that his placing well in those analytical models makes me feel a little bit better about him as well, that those are not as deterred by his usage. But again, I think those types of models, he's enough of an outlier in a lot of these ways that, you know, they could potentially be confused as much as we are just from a scouting perspective. Where does he fall in the hierarchy of the guys that we have looked at so far to you?
He's below Fultz for a couple big reasons. One is the ceiling, not like the 100%, but like the 85 to 90% ceiling for me is lower for him than for Fultz, just because his off the bounce, he's very different. And, you know, the idea of separation, like I have more concerns that about him getting to that point. And also he has a lower floor because there are ways that Lonzo just doesn't work. And so if that happens, he drops off. But he's above everybody else because remember when we talked about Jonathan Isaac, and you and I both like Jonathan Isaac, and the idea of how a low usage guy who just does a lot of the things that make a team better, that is incredibly valuable. Well, Lonzo Ball doesn't do that defensively in the same way that Jonathan Isaac does, but he does it offensively and could be so much more than that. So I have him second in this class, even though there is that bust potential with him, just because if it doesn't work, it might really not work. But he's so smart, and from what I can tell, he works hard on his game. And I think that it's going to work. And also because there isn't that other guy. So like Dennis Smith, who I like and has a high ceiling. I think you can make an argument he has a higher ceiling than Lonzo Ball. Very different guy, but just because of his incredible athleticism. But he has these other concerns, which are very, very real and need to be there. So with the lack of that other guy, you know, the real foil to him, I feel pretty good about having him second and taking him second.
I second just about everything you say. In particular, who I wanted to elaborate on was the idea of his upside, just because I find it difficult to believe that he's ever going to be, you know, a very good one-on-one scorer, and that you're always going to be a little bit limited there to being one of the best players. I mean, you basically, if you're not that good of a one-on-one scorer and you're a point guard, I mean, even Chris Paul, you know, he's been able to create shots when he wanted to, when he needed to. You know, I don't think that Lonzo Ball is going to be as good at that as Chris Paul, and Paul is probably, you know, your lowest usage guy that you really think of as a superstar. You know, generally when Blake Griffin's been healthy, Paul's been in the 23-24% usage. This guy had an 18% usage in college. You know, and generally your usage is going to go down when you get to the pros. Now, he could certainly improve that, and he was playing on a pretty loaded team, and they played very unselfishly, and they had other guards, Holiday, Bryce Alford, who could handle the ball and get them into the offense. So that's not as concerning, but I agree. It's hard to think of. And of course, the other comparison that's been made to him is Jason Kidd. I think that's actually not a bad comparison. Kidd was never really that great creating his own shot one-on-one. I think Lonzo can be more efficient than Kidd. I mean, the problem with Kidd was that, you know, he was shooting like low 40s, high 30s some years before then. This is before he evolved into kind of being more of a spot-up three-point guy in his late Dallas days. So if he... And so I see that as kind of his upside. I think Jason Kidd's maybe a little overrated historically as well. But obviously, if he has the career that Jason Kidd had, you'd be ecstatic to get him with the number two pick. But he does remind me of Kidd with the passing, the size at the point guard position, his just pushing the ball in transition, running it down people's throats, and then just the basketball IQ on both ends as well. And I think he can be a better finisher at the rim than Kidd, and a better shooter as well. But, you know, whether he's going to be able to be the force that Kidd was, you know, I'm not saying that, but I think that is a pretty legitimate comparison, because Ball, you know, again, is not a natural scorer to me.
I loved Kidd, basically, you know, Bay Area guy. He's I remember back when 92, when his high school team, I think it was St. Joseph Notre Dame, was going for the high school championship. I believe I watched that game on local TV. And I remember Kidd as being somebody who was better at young Kidd at getting to a spot and being undeniable in that way than Lonzo is right now. But I think that
he had more strength than Lonzo, for sure.
Right. And so I think that's a part of it. But again, it's a reasonable comparison. I don't think that there's something crazy on that. And something I think we should just convey this a little bit. You talked about it in terms of certain elements. Just a basic one. Lonzo Ball is the best passer to enter the NBA since.
That's a good one. Let me think on that for a second.
While you think about it, for me, the answer is probably Rubio. Because I think back to also Rubio benefited from taking a couple years before he entered the NBA, you know, that he did have have that period of time. Chris Paul is another one on that list, you know, LeBron a couple of years before that. And he's different, you know, in certain ways than those guys, but I think he's in that conversation and he's a better passer than Ben Simmons was. And we loved Ben Simmons. It's part of the reason we both had him number one overall.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to say. I haven't seen enough of Simmons really working in an NBA offense and with the ball in his hands all the time. It could be that Simmons might be as good as Lonzo. But yeah, I mean, I think that his passing is unbelievable. And I would say even maybe more so than Rubio, maybe only because he's able to just draw the defense more, so he has more opportunities to pass than Rubio. I think we'll end up seeing that potentially. But yeah, I mean, I think he can definitely be in that area of some of the best passers that we've seen in the NBA for sure. So there are, I mean, if you want to just look at it more in terms of, all right, who's in the league right now that you would say would be in his class as a passer? You know, Paul, James, maybe Ben Simmons, if he can fulfill his potential. James Harden is a great passer, but he doesn't play unselfishly the way that Paul does in terms of just like letting other people, like setting other people up so that they can make their own move as opposed to making the move and then getting somebody open. You know, I think that's an important aspect as well that a lot of point guards kind of don't realize, is that it's about getting someone in position so that they can start their move instead of just take their wide open shot. You know, a lot of point guards kind of insist on making the play themselves. So yeah, I'm not, other than those that I mentioned, John Wall would probably be the other one that you could put in that category. I think in terms of his passing, he's has the potential to be right up there with those guys, and there's nobody else I would look at as like, wow, this guy's an unbelievable passer compared to Lonzo. So that's an important thing to note. And so it's just, he's got all these great skills. If he can just do enough to keep the defense honest with his scoring, then I think he can be really a wonderful player. And I agree with you, he would be my number two on my draft board right now, with the caveat that we haven't looked at Monk yet and we haven't looked at De'Aaron Fox yet either. Those, I think, are the only guys remaining that seriously could potentially factor in there. All right, we got to get to some news here, but first, this from Smile Direct Club. When I was younger, I had braces on both my top and bottom teeth, and after I completed the treatment, I always wore my retainer on the top because, you know, those are the teeth that people see. But I stupidly kind of just let my retainer lapse, and now my bottom teeth could be better. I looked into invisible aligners. They cost up to $5,000 on average. I'm like, all right, it's not really worth it. Smile Direct Club aligners are 70% left, and you could say 70% less. You could save even more with insurance or an FSA as well. There's two easy ways to pay. You can either pay with a single payment of $1,700, or you can take advantage of Smile Pay, which is just $250 down and then $99 a month for 17 months, no credit check required. The way to get started with them, you would normally get an at-home impression for only $95. I did that process. It took me about 20 minutes. You basically combine these two kinds of putty that activate, so it'll start to harden. Wear each impression, top and bottom. You'll make four in total, two top, two bottom, for 3 minutes and 30 seconds each. Take it off, mail it back to them, and then they will get you started. Better yet, our listeners can save 50% on your evaluation cost with this special offer. Go to Smile Direct Club, use the promo code CAPSPACE. That's Smile Direct Club, code CAPSPACE for 50% off your evaluation today. Easy to remember, CAPSPACE, of course, as we talk about it all the time on the program. Also note, this is only available in the U.S. except for North Carolina. Once again, smiledirectclub.com, promo code CAPSPACE for 50% off your evaluation today. And if your aligners aren't a good fit, you get your money back. So no risk there if it doesn't work out for you. Smiledirectclub.com, promo code CAPSPACE. So we're a little overdue on news. Let's get to some of that. And starting with, in the same vein, Lonzo Ball not going to work out for the Boston Celtics, will work out for the Lakers in about a week or so, as reported by Shams Charania. Do you make anything out of him not working out for the Celtics other than just already clearly wants to be with the Lakers?
No, I don't. I actually think it's a disappointment just because I think he would be a nice fit on the Celtics, though I have Fultz over Ball on my board, considering the uncertainty with Boston and how many pieces they can add. But I understand an LA kid wanting to play for the Lakers, so I'm not going to read too much into it, especially considering one of the other interesting parts is I think he expressed a willingness to work out for the Sixers. So I'm not exactly sure how all that pieces together, but it's interesting, I guess.
Yeah, well, you always need to establish a floor for yourself as well. And I would be very surprised if the Lakers don't take Ball, but they are at least going to do their due diligence on some other guys. Ball will not be doing anything other than a one-on-one workout. We haven't seen somebody that high in the draft do anything other than a one-on-one workout in quite some time, so that also is not a surprise. But, you know, if I were Lonzo Ball, I probably wouldn't want to go to the Celtics either, I mean, especially because you've got these issues of trying to get your own shoe brand off the ground. He's from LA. You could be a huge star with the Lakers, bringing them back to prominence. And I think one of the, maybe I don't want to say dirty little secrets, but one of the underplayed things is about being a rookie is it's kind of good for them to go to a bad team. Sometimes you can spread your wings. You can average a lot of points per game. You could win rookie of the year. You know, Jaylen Brown might have been the best 2016 draftee this season with Ben Simmons out, but we'll never know that because he was on the Celtics and playing 10 minutes a game and had to get better for you. Now he may end up being a better player ultimately, but certainly in the short term, a rookie doesn't want to come in and play 10 minutes a game. They want to play 35 minutes a game and average 20 points. And so that's Lonzo Ball. If he goes to the Celtics, he's probably going to play 20 minutes a game next year, you know? So it's totally understandable to me that he would do everything that he can to not get drafted by the Celtics. And if anyone wants to say, oh, what a prima donna, like, no, why wouldn't you try to control your own destiny as much as you can? I never really understood why everyone like thinks like, oh, he doesn't want to, like, that you're somehow a bad person for not wanting to play in a certain location.
Steph Curry didn't work out for the Warriors.
Yeah, and Boston, I mean, if they really believed in him that much, they could still take him anyway. In other news, Travis Schlenk, now former assistant general manager for the Golden State Warriors, he is now the new Hawks general manager, slotting in above Wes Wilcox, who has moved on to be a special advisor, but also actually will now be interviewing for the Bucks GM job, which we'll talk about in a minute. But Schlenk, it's interesting because his reputation is he is a straight shooter. He is the guy in the room who will say, you know what, like, I don't think this is right, even if it's the unpopular opinion. You know, he tells people what they need to hear. You know, that's kind of his reputation, as well as, you know, having a great scouting eye, of course, and he's had no small part in a lot of those Warriors successes in the draft. But that approach, if that is indeed what he was selling in interviews, is very interesting to me because these Hawks, to my perspective, they need to be told that they're not that good, right? Like, if you're gonna bring back, yeah, okay, we were the 5 seed in the East this year, but we're on the downswing. You bring back Paul Millsap on a max contract. He's supposed to have these direct negotiations with owner Tony Ressler, which is terrifying in terms of the contract that they might end up giving him. But that's what they need, the Hawks, is to say, hey, we kind of need to rebuild a little bit here. We can't just run these guys back, or we're going to be consigning ourselves to 40 wins next year and 35 wins the year after that and 30 wins the year after that, probably. I mean, not certainly, but that seems to be the trajectory.
What's more, it would have been good to have a voice like his in the room in January and February when they made the decisions to keep Paul Millsap and Thabo Sefolosha and all these other guys that they could have gotten something for instead of having the season that they ended up having.
Yeah, and I don't know whether that's the approach that Schlenk took to in his interviews. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe they're not going to do that, but he does follow that reputation, I think it is something that the Hawks need. Just a little bit of news on Chris Paul's free agent. Agency. Mark Stein reporting that the Clippers had a little bit of concern about the Spurs. Woj responding saying no, he thinks that the Spurs targeting Chris Paul is unlikely. And I felt somewhat similarly to Woj, if only because the mechanics of opening up the space are going to lead to some bad optics. Pau Gasol, are they going to trade him away on that player option? Or Tony Parker, who has said that he, to the French sports daily L'Equipe, did I say that right, French speaker?
L'Equipe,
thank you. That he is targeting a January return from that torn quad tendon. Are they going to move on from those guys? Would they trade Danny Green, who I think if they want to actually be good next year, they need to keep him around. They really would have to go. They would have to not bring back Patty Mills, which I think would be an easier decision. But Parker and Gasol, I mean, those are the two guys who basically would almost certainly have to go. Or maybe trading Aldridge, which again, I don't think would really make sense. Like, they need Aldridge. He's a good player. Gasol and Parker are the ones who are making enough money that you feel like you can upgrade on that slot. It does seem somewhat un-Spurs-like to just just take a franchise icon in Parker, a Hall of Famer, and just dump him or stretch him or something like that, especially if he is really planning on making a return next year.
I think that there's a possibility that both of these are true, that the Clippers are worried about it and take it seriously, and that the Spurs are unlikely to do it. And I think that's probably the most likely thing, because the other part of this is if Pau Gasol opts out, then it gets a lot clearer for the Spurs. And I don't think that's going to happen, but it's certainly possible. And Parker being out for a little while does give them some plausible deniability. Maybe say, hey, you know, you can spend a year here. Maybe they could express an openness to re-signing him or something. I don't think it's going to happen, but there is a possibility. And I understand why that possibility terrifies the Clippers, because the Spurs can make a better sales pitch than the Clippers can, other than money.
Yeah. And Zach Lowe also reported on a podcast with Kevin Arnovitz that there is some mutual interest between Paul and the Spurs. Opt-outs. Dwayne Dedmon, unsurprisingly, opting out of the second year at about $3 million of that 1+1 he signed for the room exception. I assume he will get more than that. Danilo Gallinari, also another unsurprising opt-out in Denver, as reported by Woj. Gallo was due...
16.1.
Ah, thank you.
I was working on my Nuggets off-season preview.
Was due $16.1 million. I had it right at the top of my head, too. You just beat me to it, of course. No, but that's not unexpected. He's going to get way more than that in guaranteed money as well. And we'll talk more about that when we do Denver's off-season preview. CJ Miles also opting out of his player option. He was due only about $4 million. And I think, again, at age 30, he will do well better than that in guaranteed money. And in a wing market that is thin, even for guys who kind of squint hard and they look like they can play some 3-and-D, and Miles shot well on three-pointers last year, 41%. I think he'll should have a pretty good market. What do we have in terms of some injury news?
Well, so Denzel Valentine had an ankle procedure, which is not surprising. It was a scope, I believe, and he had persistent ankle issues this year. And then Miles Plumlee had a right knee. It's debridement, right?
Yes.
Debridement. So he's going to be out. What was then 6 to 8 weeks. Now it's getting further into that.
Yeah, that one slipped past us in early April. That acquisition continues to go well for the Hornets. You remember he missed basically all the regular season once he got acquired with a calf injury, and then that surgery. But only 3 years and $12 million a year left on that contract now for the Hornets. Last thing, Magic Johnson was quoted as saying basically the only player that he wouldn't consider moving would be Brandon Ingram. And regardless of whether that's true or not, what do you think of that just as a stance?
I think they should consider moving everyone, so everyone but one is pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, I know Ingram has a lot of potential and you want to believe in your own young players, but he didn't show enough to me last year where it's like, all right, we just cannot move this guy, you know. And D'Angelo Russell, I think the only one I wouldn't consider moving would be number two pick, probably Lonzo Ball. So we'll see. And that is somewhat of a disappointment that they've had two number two picks in a row and neither of them looks like a surefire cornerstone at this point, but that is the vagaries of the draft. And it's not like either of those picks were picks that like not everyone else would have made, you know. And if anyone wouldn't have taken Russell, they would have taken Jahlil Okafor, which looks even worse.
Right. And while you like Jaylen Brown, it doesn't look like in that next couple of picks. And I know there are people who look, you know, 10 spots down in the draft, not necessarily saying that for Ingram, but you know, in those first couple with him, none of those guys are really lighting the world on fire either this early.
Joe Vardon out of Cleveland reporting that the Milwaukee Bucks in their GM search have interest in David Griffin as well. It had been initially reported when Justin Zanuck came over that he was likely the GM in waiting. Now that John Hammond has left to become a GM in Orlando, it was thought to be that, all right, the reason he's leaving is because Zanuck is here and now Zanuck is going to ascend, but maybe the Bucks feel like they're in a little bit different spot in terms of the desirability of their jobs. So they're going to do their due diligence. And you'd think if they could get Griffin, they would certainly do that. But who else is on the Bucks radar now, as reported by Woj and his little, you know, one paragraph, I'm going to do you a favor and mention your guy and mention the highlights of your career article that he likes to do around this time of year.
So Pete Dinwiddie, who I believe is still with the Pacers, Ed Stefanski, Memphis, who was also the GM before Sam Hinkie in Philadelphia, Wilcox, we already mentioned, and then Arturas Karnasovas, who is with the Nuggets.
Yeah, Arturas, well known for his international scouting acumen, also previously of the Rockets, and I'm going to do the same thing that Woj does, actually. But I'm not doing it as a favor. Very good international scouting eye. Was a finalist for the Nets job last year. Stefanski saying that he was the GM before Hinkie is actually probably a little bit too negative on him, because actually he left in 2011 and Hinkie came in 2013. So he was not responsible for the Andrew Bynum trade.
That's true. That's a good point.
Wes Wilcox also reportedly in the mix there as well. And they're supposed to even maybe interview more candidates than that. Rod Thorne actually is running the search now, supposedly, for the Bucks. And who's the last guy that I didn't mention yet?
Pete Dinwiddie.
Yes. Yeah, Dinwiddie started off as a lawyer doing mostly business stuff, then transitioned to doing cap, now does scouting stuff as well for the Pacers. Although that's interesting, because they've granted permission, Dinwiddie is poised to move up now, maybe to be the number two guy behind Kevin Pritchard with the departure of Larry Bird in Indiana. Meanwhile, in other executive news, the Magic, with their new president of basketball operations, Jeff Weltman, were actually required to give compensation to the Raptors.
And the compensation they gave up is notable, because yes, it is the lesser of their two 2018 second round picks, but their two 2018 second round picks are their own and the Lakers, both of which should be very good.
Yeah, difficult to imagine that's going to fall outside the top 40, and that's where you really get the value in the second round, is those first 10 picks of the second round. I think that will do it for today's show. Stay tuned in tomorrow, of course, when we'll be wrapping up game one of the 2017 NBA Finals. It is finally here. Don't forget about our sponsors today, Smile Direct Club. Visit smiledirectclub.com and use the promo code CAPSPACE to get 50% off your evaluation. And Audible. Audible.com/CAPSPACE let you start your 30-day trial and your first free Audible book. Talk to you all tomorrow night. Till then.